All right, so how you guys doing? Okay, so last time I was sort of trying to take you on sort of a set of highlights in sort of multiverse thing, cosmological stuff is concerned, and thought I would add some more. Boy, is that fuzzy or what? There's nothing I can do about it because the touch screen never. So, if you like fuzz, you're welcome to stare at that one. If not, stare at that one. I don't have any control over it now. Okay, so we talked about a lot of things last time, just a lot of the reminder. And remember that if you look at the galaxies out there, you find that the further away you are, the faster they seem to recede from us. And you can measure that velocity of recession by looking at supernova in the distant galaxies. And you can relate their absolute luminosity by the time over which they take in this. You can actually see the supernova flaring up right here in this distant galaxy. And it turns out that if you record a bunch of supernova and you look at how bright they are as a function of time, you notice they don't all fall on the same curve, but you'll notice that the ones that are lower tend to happen over a shorter period of time, so this is the number of days. And so it turns out you can find a scale factor which allows you to basically look at how fast the light curve turns on and turns off, and then use that to calibrate it in such a way that you can basically get them all on the same curve, which allows you to then, within the factor of having to pull out the scale factor, you tell how bright they are by how fast the light curve turns on and off. And this is really important because in terms of knowing what the brightness is, it's really hard to know what kind of crap is in the space between you and it when it's so far away. And but in terms of time, there's nothing that really distorts that. So knowing how fast the thing turns on and off is relatively easy to do. And then you can look at the positions of the spectral lines to see how much they're redshifted to determine the velocity. So you can look at the spectral lines of material in the supernova itself, for example. And here's an example of, as a function of wavelength in angstroms, if you look at the light that's coming from, say, the supernova that we just saw, and you spread it out in terms of frequency, you see a lot of structure here, and people pay a lot of attention to these dips and valleys because they correspond to spectral lines of absorption or emission, depending on what's going on. So, as we've talked about at length, right, if you know that the universe is expanding and you go backwards in time, the idea is that the space is expanding. We go backwards in time and you get this timeline of what could have happened without worrying about exactly what's going on right at the start yet. So you imagine the universe is getting hotter and cooler and you go through various phase transitions, which we've talked about. We've talked about a phase transition from sort of quarks and gluons and photons and stuff into protons and neutrons. And then there's a period where you have enough free neutrons. They haven't decayed away yet, so they decay away very quickly. This happens at about 1 microsecond after the Big Bang. They decay away within, you know, 8 or 10 minutes. But during about 3 minutes, you have enough free neutrons and things are dense enough, you have a lot of collisions, that you form light nuclei here. And you can model how much you get of the different light nuclei, so it's a period called Big Bang nucleosynthesis, and we measure that, so that's predictive of the Big Bang. Then there's another phase transition where you go from hot, dense plasma of charged particles, which where the photons are basically passing through frosted glass, if you want to think about it, they're just scattered so you don't image anything, to the point where you begin to form neutral atoms at about 380,000 years after the Big Bang. And at that point, the universe becomes transparent and those photons come to us from all directions, and it's known as the cosmic microwave background. So if we look at the light coming to us from all directions at a wavelength of about, it's in the microwaves, we can see see as a function of frequency, a very nice black body curve that corresponds to something below near the temperature of 2.7 degrees Kelvin, which of course is very cold. This light was actually emitted when the universe was about 3,000 degrees. Hotter than that, you didn't have neutral atoms and it wasn't transparent. And then when it cooled down, those photons began to come to us, but that was at about 3,000 degrees. So you would think it should glow at 3,000 degrees, but as those photons have been traveling to us for some 13, some billion years, the universe's space has also been expanding, which literally changes the wavelength of the photons and has made them now they correspond to this temperature. So again, something very predictive of the radiation from the Big Bang. So if we think about looking further and further back in time by looking at light that's coming from farther and farther distances, here's where we are in the Midlands. We begin to look out, you'll see closer stars, then you'll begin to see galaxies and galactic clusters and things all the way out here. But then you'll reach a point where basically you're going back in time far enough that the first galaxies haven't been formed. So there's a period in here where it's sort of a dark period where you had coalescence into stars and galaxies sort of forming. And then if you go far enough back, you'll actually effectively see the time that corresponds to when the photons from the cosmic microwave background started streaming free, which would be about 13.4 billion years ago. So that's a bit what you see as you look back. We talked a bit about Big Bang nucleosynthesis and the fact that after about 3 minutes in time, you stabilize in terms of the ratios or the fraction of the matter in the universe that corresponds to certain light nuclei. And we talked about where the elements come from. One of the important things is that only a few light elements come from the time of the Big Bang, and many of the rest come from... Many of the rest come from fusion in stars, and then you get fusion in stars during supernova, which would be these sort of gray things mostly. These happen to be man-made elements that they may be made in supernova as well, but they decay very fast, so you wouldn't find any of those around Earth today that came from supernova. All right, so we have lots of reasons to believe in the Big Bang, the expansion of space, the cosmic microwave background, which is exactly what people expect, and there are ways in which you can look farther back. The older galaxies are galaxies where the distribution of the elements is more primordial. It's more what comes from right after the Big Bang, because in those early galaxies, so as you begin to look further and further back in time, you're looking at galaxies formed earlier in the universe, and there hadn't been enough star formation to actually cook the elements and fuse them into other things. So the idea is the Big Bang just had to happen. But if you take it by itself, it doesn't work so well because the Big Bang has lots of problems. We talked about the fact that the geometry of space appears to be flat on a large scale of the universe, and that's a special case. A big problem happens to be that the photons from the cosmic microwave background, you know, one direction come from space that was causally disconnected from space for the photons coming from the other direction at the time the Big Bang, the cosmic microwave background, was emitted. And so the problem there is that the temperature in those regions of space is uniform along Cartesian tip, and so how can something be uniform in temperature if it never had all its parts causally connected? So that's a big issue. You have problems with straight Big Bang about what happens when you have an infinite density of points. There's the idea that there's a type of particle that I'm not making the case for you, but there are theoretical reasons to believe this particle should have some abundance in our universe. We see none of them. And then there's some basic, there is structure, whereas in the Big Bang itself, there's no mechanism whereby you generate the structure. So the way around this that is compelling to most cosmologists and basically underlies what we call the standard model of cosmology now is the idea that you start off really, really small, and then there's this very short period of hyperluminal expansion. And the times that we're talking about, even though we can't see very well today in these slides, the times are about 10 to the minus 35 to 10 to the minus 33 seconds after the start of the Big Bang. And the point is, you start out as something which is like a quantum fluctuation in energy, which we sort of deal with all the time in quantum mechanics. But it's small and causally connected, could have arbitrary geometry in terms of the space you will have within it for quantum fluctuations in energy. And you take that thing and you blow it up over that extremely short period of time by orders about 10 to the 50. So about 50 orders of magnitude. So that it is vastly larger than the distance light would have traveled during that same time. So you take something very small and causally connected and make it much larger than the size of the observable universe. And that stretches the geometry out, so no matter how arbitrary the curvature was, you get flat geometry. And the other thing, lots of other things happen. You basically have quantum fluctuations in energy in this region of space that you then blow up to cosmic scales. And so, since you have those quantum fluctuations of all different sizes and magnitudes and shapes, if you will, within this bit of space that you then blow up, that will give you asymmetries in the universe that we have at that time. And if you look at the cosmic microwave background coming at us, you actually find evidence for those asymmetries, which would be fluctuations in the temperature of the cosmic microwave background that's coming to us. So this strange idea of blowing things up happens to fix all of these various problems that we're talking about with the Big Bang. Space that we think was causally disconnected at the time of cosmic microwave background emission had been causally connected pre-inflation and then had blown up to be causally disconnected through inflation. You don't ever have just a singularity. If you have some early density of particles that you then span the universe to be hugely huge size, the density of those goes to zero. And then the fact that you have these energy fluctuations should lead to energy asymmetries in the universe that can condense into regions of greater or lesser density material and give you galactic clusters and things like that. So all these problems go away with this idea of inflation. And then we have surprises. We mentioned these last time. The surprise, there are a couple of different surprises that come out that aren't really part of the cosmological, aren't thrust upon us by the Big Bang and the expansion of the universe, but have to be factored into the problem somehow. The color, actually, this won't work at all because some of the color is missing. But the main thing is, if you analyze either galaxies and galactic clusters or stars going around galaxies, you find that the rotation rate as they go around, from the rotation rate, you would expect to see a lot more mass in the galaxy than we can see based on the brightness and numbers of stars. And it's not a small difference. It's almost a factor of 10. So that means there's a lot of non-bright matter there. And then the question is, what's the nature of that matter? And for many years, people thought it was evidence that we had matter tied up into stars that are not emitting light, so they weren't heavy enough, or things like black holes and such, and that there were so many of these that, in fact, we didn't see them, but there was enough mass there to do this. People have now a lot of evidence that shows that although there are some of those things, those are not sufficient to account for this by any stretch of the imagination. And one of the ways you can do that is to actually, if you have lots of dark objects roaming around, for example, in our galaxy, every now and then they will creep in front of something like a distant star or a distant galaxy. And when that happens, you can look at the distortion of the light. It's like a lens. It's called the gravitational lensing. on it, we actually get a pattern of light that comes around the dark object. And so this doesn't happen very often, but people have done astronomical surveys and can look at how often it does happen, and from this they can infer an estimate of the number of dark normal matter objects that are out there, and they find it's not nearly enough to take care of this problem. So people believe that there is a form of matter out there which we call dark matter that basically doesn't interact with normal matter, or at least if it does, it's very seldom and very weakly, almost like neutrinos. So that we call dark matter. It's called cold. Oh boy, I'm forgetting why. Cold basically is a measure of its kinetic energy. It's not relativistic. And I can't remember, there's experimental reason why you don't believe that it's moving relativistically. I can't remember what it is right now, so sorry. But the cold represents basically the thermal distribution, how fast the stuff is going typically, and dark means that it doesn't interact with light. Then another big surprise that we ran into is that if you do very careful survey of galaxies and how fast they move away from us, and you do it using supernova, and you go to farther and farther distances away from us, what you find is that you find something consistent with the expansion of the universe actually speeding up. So the idea is, if we were to look at, for example, how, if this is the distance, and this is sort of a measure of the velocity, well, this is how far back you go, and you sort of have a measure of the velocity by the slope here. What you have is, early on, the universe was expanding fairly fast because the slope is fairly high, and it sort of began to slow down, and then you reach a point where we actually have data, and so we fit this curve, and what you find is that it is starting to turn back up, which means it's beginning to accelerate. If, in fact, all you had was a bunch of gravity, that you started out with some fast expansion that was slowing down and slowing down and slowing down, you would actually have some curve that looks something like this. So it's fairly well established that we have an accelerating expansion of the universe. We call it dark energy because in the equations that govern the expansion of the space of the universe, you can make the space expand by adding in a term that has energy units of a certain sign. We don't really know exactly what it is, but we know that it's there, whatever it is. And now we have to take into account all of these things. We talked a bit about the fact that you don't break energy conservation with this weird idea of inflation. And we've talked a bit about potentially what in principle could drive inflation. So you might, for example, have energy, the vacuum of space imbued with a form of potential energy, if in fact you have it, these six extra dimensions of space compactified in many different ways. Different ways in which you compactify, you'll effectively give the vacuum of space different potential energies. And at certain level of those potential energies, you'll have inflation. So we believe in this model that we have to have structure, we have to have slightly different colors, slightly different temperatures in the cosmic microwave background if we look at the pictures coming at us. And from about 1992 to now, we've developed instruments that have better and better resolution. And in fact, we can see, if we project what we see in all dimensions, all directions down to two dimensions, and we then color code temperature differences or frequency differences that correspond to about 1 × 10^5, you can see that there is variation. And as I mentioned earlier, you expect to see particular patterns in this variation, because if you believe you understand how quantum mechanics can give you fluctuations in energy of different sizes, remember, from the uncertainty principle, a small fluctuation in energy is going to hang around longer than a big fluctuation in energy, to be consistent with this, with the uncertainty principle. So a way to think about it is, the half region of space, I can more or less predict the frequency with which I would expect to see different size energy fluctuations. And so I have this going on, and now I blow it up to cosmic scales. And so I actually have a pretty decent prediction of what I expect these initial sets of energy fluctuations to look like. Those energy fluctuations, once they're there, that energy turns into particles, and that energy curves space because it has, that's what gravity is in general relativity. And so you expect to see basically the universe be filled with regions where you have variations in the amount of matter that correspond to this kind of pattern. And you can think of those as pressure, as regions where you have greater and larger densities, so they're like pressure waves, sound waves, and they'll evolve with time. So from the time that's very early in the early stage of the universe up to about 380,000 years, where you basically get this snapshot, those shapes will have evolved. And the way in which they evolve is going to depend on how fast the space is expanding, how much matter versus cold matter you have, because matter will exert pressure on itself and will cause these regions to expand or move, whereas cold dark matter doesn't interact so much with itself. So if I had a bunch of cold dark matter here, it's not going to exert pressure. So the sound wave characteristics of dark matter are very different from normal matter. So you have some degree of sensitivity to the initial quantum fluctuations, the amount of cold dark matter, and the amount of normal matter in the universe, as well as the degree to which the universe is expanding, in order to try to model this sort of structure that we see. So people model it by effectively looking at how big and with what frequency different sizes of dots exist, or structures exist, in the cosmic microwave background. So large structures are given by small L's, little structures are given by larger L's, and if you actually do a frequency analysis of how often you see certain size objects, you get this kind of curve called the power spectrum, and you see data lying on it. This is sort of older stuff, sort of 2003. And if you do a modern analysis from modern data, you can see the data fits some structure very well. The data is very precise now. So this curve is very particular sets of peaks here. And it turns out that in order to get this kind of structure, you have to have a universe where the matter that we understand makes up about 5%, dark matter makes up about 25% of the energy in the universe, and the rest of the energy budget and the whole problem appears to be in the form of this potential energy tied up in the actual structure of the vacuum of space itself, which we call dark matter. And in case it sort of feels like we know a lot of things about the universe, I just want to point out to you that we really don't know about the nature of dark matter, and we don't know about the nature of dark energy. In fact, we didn't really know either one existed at all. Dark matter, the first evidence for that was uncovered in about 1930s. And then people didn't take it very seriously until about 1970s, and even now in the last 10 years people have started to take it a lot more seriously. The dark energy that came about when people discovered the accelerating expansion of the universe, and before that it was just a complete unknown. So 95% of the universe, the energy budget, we really don't even know the fundamental nature of it yet. So if we take the modern data, actually this is not quite modern data, but it was data about 2007, and you look and you fit different cosmological models to it, here's one that has inflation with dark energy. And here's one where you have inflation without dark energy, doesn't fit the data very well. And then you have some different cosmologies. You can just sort of look at the picture and get some idea of how powerful the data is in terms of distinguishing different cosmological models. So when people tell you that they believe the universe is 25% dark matter, 75% dark energy, they're finding with pretty good precision that's the only model they can get that fits the data of the power spectrum of fluctuations on the cosmic background. So it's an extremely powerful observable and experimental technique. Okay, so this is a very recent paper by Planck, the Planck Satellite Collaboration, and this corresponds to people who have just completed an analysis of that really high resolution cosmic microwave background work. And one of the things they'll say is that having looked at all the different cosmological models and the data that they have, which is now really quite good, they find that they call it standard slow roll single field inflation. So this is a very particular model for the way in which inflation is working, is compatible with the Planck data. This result is confirmed by other papers in the series. So they're saying that the structure that we see in cosmic microwave background is consistent with inflation. Okay. So that gets us about where we were at the end of class last time. And there's new stuff that has come about, actually came out in March 17th. And I have some headlines here. Cosmic inflation, spectacular discovery hailed, space ripples revealed, Big Bang smoking gun, primordial gravitational wave discovery heralds a whole new era in physics. So what is all this about, and why do you care? So I would say that, you know, the Big Bang was really thrust upon us, and inflation fixes all the problems of the Big Bang. But this idea of inflation is really pretty out there, and so why should we take it seriously? So the data that I just showed you from the Planck satellite, which analyzes the frequency of the different structures in the cosmic microwave background, is pretty compelling. In terms of the only way people really, one of the only ways people know how to create that kind of structure is through inflation. The F-periodic model that we talked a little bit about, and I mentioned it again, also can give you, fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background. So there may be other ways to do that. People were trying to think of a smoking gun for inflation, something that they could only imagine being caused by inflation. And that's what some people believe they've found. So the idea is the following. During inflation, we have energy fluctuations in the space. Okay? So we're sort of swallowed that. And we say that we then blow that stuff up to cosmic scale. But remember that matter and energy, both in general relativity, are distorting space-time. So if I have extremely big distortions in space-time and large energy fluctuations like you might expect in the early universe, you might expect to see evidence for those distortions. Because what happens, you not only have the energy, but you have distortion in space-time. So So I have, within this small fluctuation, quantum fluctuation that got inflated, you expect to have fluctuations in the geometry of the space-time because you have differences in the energy, you have fluctuations in the energy. And we know that energy basically distorts the space-time. So if I now take those structures and I now blow them up to be big size, then I would, you know, we sort of talk about how it flattens everything out, but it's a fabric. So you're sort of expecting to see these fluctuations in the structure of the space-time act as waves. So general relativity predicts something known as gravity waves, which if I have some big perturbation in space-time, you expect to see that literally ripple out in space-time like a fabric. So gravitational waves. So the idea is, not only do you have differences in energy or density caused by the fact that you have differences in energy and you get different densities from matter formed from that, you would also expect to see perturbations in the actual waving structure of space-time that get blown up cosmic scales as well. So the idea is that in the early stage of inflation, you have effectively the energy fluctuations which give you these differences in density literally in the system that come out after post-inflation. And then these will evolve with time depending on, again, how much dark energy you've got, how much cold dark matter you have, how much regular matter you'll have, whether these density perturbations will evolve in time. There'll be pressure. So you expect to see the sizes change and evolve through the time up until we actually see the cosmic microwave background coming off, and we see then the size of those density fluctuations by the regions with different temperatures that we measure in the cosmic microwave background. On top of that, in the early stage of the universe, because you have these curvatures in space-time that now get blown up to cosmic scales, you basically also expect to have gravitational waves form in this primordial period that then propagate in space-time. And it turns out gravitational waves have very peculiar characteristics. They, unlike waves on a string, sort of move like this. And we talked about electromagnetic waves, and we'll talk about them a bit in a moment as well. There, the electric field sort of goes up, and then it goes down, and it goes up. So it changes its orientation in that way. Gravitational waves are very different. They basically take the space that they're going through and they squeeze it this way and stretch it this way. And then as they go through, it squeezes this way and stretches that way. So it's a very peculiar type of wave that passes through. It's called a quadrupole wave. And so it's a bizarre sort of wave. Density waves tend to be your density is up, your density is down. Gravitational waves are sort of strange because they'll squeeze in one direction and stretch in the other direction and then go the other way. So they're sort of bizarre. And it turns out that this quadrupole stretching and squeezing of space will have an effect on the electric and magnetic field orientations in the cosmic microwave background. And we can measure orientations, as it turns out. So, So recall back when we talked about Maxwell's equations, electric fields and magnetic fields, we found that Maxwell's equations tell us that light consists of oscillating electric and magnetic fields, which are represented by these arrows. They oscillate basically at right angles to one another, and they oscillate at right angles to the direction of propagation of the electromagnetic wave. This is a deceptive picture because it makes it seem like it's confined in transversely to the direction of its motion. But that's not true. These arrows represent the fields that correspond to an entire plane that's headed out in right now at the x direction. So at any given moment, you will see the electric and magnetic fields with very particular orientation in the space. So you can see if we have a particular plane here, you can't see this color very well today, but this would correspond to the magnetic field in that plane of space, and this would be the, well, I guess this would be the magnetic field, this would be the electric field in that plane of space. It's pointing down. And if we wait a moment, this one will oscillate over that plane, this one will oscillate up. So why do we care? It turns out that the electric field for the light, or the photons that are coming toward you, can have a certain orientation. And that orientation is what we call the polarization of the light. And it can be complicated. It can be along a line, but can also be something that varies with time. So if your eye was sensitive to the direction of the electric field, if you will, as the light is passing through your eye, sometimes as a function of time, the electric field vector is moving in a circle. Sometimes it will just move in a straight line. And these are just different types of polarization. So it turns out that if you have space being stretched and squeezed in a time-dependent way, in the way that gravity waves would do, then light with one polarization may get shifted to a different polarization by the strangeness of the shift, of the squeezing of the space. So it turns out that if gravity waves exist, which basically is evidence of quantum gravity in the early stages of the universe that then got expanded into cosmic scales. So here again is a picture of light propagating toward you, and the orientation of the electric field vector could be in different ways. That would be a measure of polarization. And it turns out that if you have gravity waves coming from quantum gravity expanded up to cosmic scales, and then have the light that's bouncing around the universe basically interacting or passing through space that's going through this kind of strange oscillation, it turns out that you will induce a certain type of polarization in the photons coming from the cosmic microwave background. And there's an experiment that has just been built, this BICEP2 collaboration. They have built an experiment that looks at the polarization of the light coming from the cosmic microwave background. So it is in the South Pole. So here's a plane that just brought some equipment. You see it has sleds on the bottom and the wheels. So it's really out in the middle of nowhere. And they do this because they really need, basically, the South Pole is as close to being in space as you can be without being in space, because the atmosphere is extraordinarily dry. And one of the biggest problems with astronomy in other parts of the globe is that you have a lot of humidity in the atmosphere. Depends a little on what frequency range you want to look at as to whether it should bother you too much. But there's a series of experiments and telescopes down in the South Pole, and one of them is this BICEP 2 experiment. And so here's a scale of the size. It would correspond to this one, I think. And it's really a telescope that can look at a small angular region of cosmic microwave background and do a polarization analysis of the light that is coming. And it keeps track of exactly where it's pointing in the space as it looks at it. So here's sort of the size of the telescope itself, and then it has a lot of pieces. They're measuring microwaves, remember, what would correspond to something glowing at a very cold temperature. So it's not just an optical telescope here. It's sort of a different set of mechanisms it takes to measure it. At any rate, here's the paper that they just published. Detection of what they call B-mode polarization at degree angular scales. So the idea is they're looking at certain size scales on the cosmic microwave background. So these would correspond to size scales where whatever they're seeing would basically have to come from the primordial fluctuations of gravity waves. So the fluctuations that have been blown up the cosmic scale. We will certainly have polarization induced from fluctuations that happen since then, but it'd be a much smaller scale. So this is over, and a degree scale is a big part of the sky, corresponding to a pretty big region of space. And just to point out a few things. So they're looking at the cosmic microwave background using a polarimeter specifically designed to search for the signal of inflationary gravitational waves, and they say in the B-mode power spectrum. So that's a measure of this type of polarization that they're expecting to see.
So what do they see?
Oh, I wanted to say a couple of other things. So this is just a quote from the paper. Although highly successful, the inflationary paradigm represents a vast extrapolation from well-tested regimes in physics. So why do we believe in inflation? It invokes quantum effects in highly curved space-time at energies near 10 to the 16 GeV. This is huge. And time scales of less than 10 to the minus 32 seconds. A definitive test of this paradigm would be of fundamental importance. Gravitational waves generated by inflation have the potential to provide such a definitive test. Inflation predicts that the quantization of the gravitational field coupled to the exponential expansion produces gravitational waves with a certain spectral shape, so certain frequencies, certain sizes. And then they feel that, they say that these distortions in space will actually induce what they call quadrupole anisotropies in the radiation field. So basically saying it will induce polarization in the light coming from the cosmic microwave background in a strange sort of pattern. And so this is the picture that they measure. So these are sort of bigger than degree scales. And what you're looking at are the color coding corresponds to sort of the color coding you've seen in the cosmic microwave background so far. Now you're zeroing in on a small region of it. And these little lines correspond to a measure of the direction of the electric field for the photons they're getting from that part of space. And if you look at this picture, what you'll see is that the direction of the electric field, that is the polarization of these photons, has sort of a curliness that has some degree of association with these objects. Okay? And it turns out that the gravitational waves coming from primordial inflation is the only way people know to induce this sort of circulation pattern that you see here. So the fact that they measure, so that's what they call E-modes, is the degree of circulation. If it just sort of diverged away and didn't circulate, then it would the B-mode measure would be zero, and it wouldn't be evidence of inflation. But the fact that they see this curliness around these objects, that's the big deal, because the only way they know to induce that is through inflation, gravitational waves that came from inflation.
So they've measured it, and I guess,
you know, is this the final word? Scientists are actually a bit of a cautious bunch. A lot of people are very excited about this. I'm absolutely certain that Alan Guth and his friends who sort of came up with inflation are going to have their names floated for Nobel Prizes, for sure, as well as the people who actually made this measurement. It's that big a deal. I think we're going to see two sets of Nobel Prizes coming out of this work if it holds up. So if it holds up, it's a complicated analysis, and there are other experiments that are looking, so they'll have to verify this. One of the funny things about this is that they not only see the effect, they see the effect to be stronger than flat-out inflation would be. So that's actually one of the stranger puzzles with this. So it could be that something else is coming. But many scientists look at this as sort of a smoking gun, that the only way they know to induce it is if inflation really happened. So this idea of inflation is completely wacky, but if you had inflation, then you've got the multiverse. So we've talked a bit about that. All of a sudden, you have a universe of reality that is vastly larger than our observable universe. And due to the technical issues we're having with projectors, you can't even see, but let's imagine that this corresponds to the size of reality that will be the largest part of reality we will ever be causally connected. Because space is expanding, in fact, it's moving away from us faster than the speed of light. So there's a finite region of the universe that we can be in causal contact with. But we know, because of inflation, that the universe has to be vastly larger than that region. So that means there has to be lots of other universe-sized regions of reality that will never be in causal contact with each other, and they'll never be in causal contact with each other. And that is a multiple universe, by our definition of the universe. And if for all of these regions that were born in the same inflationary bit, the space-time should have the same characteristics, should have the same way in which those extra dimensions are twisted up. And that basically determines things like the physical constants and the way in which the physical laws of our universe operate. So that means we have a vast region, an infinite number of universe-sized regions that share the same basic physical laws and only differ by the initial energy fluctuation pattern that they had to begin with. And so, if there are an infinite number of them, you can do an analysis and basically decide that anything that could happen has happened, but as long as it adheres to our type of
physical laws. But then the problem is that
when we have this mechanism for inflation, it turns out that if you have inflating space, we don't know how to stop it except at one point, where you might have a fluctuation in the structure of the vacuum in space-time and cause the inflation to slow down and give you a condition that's close to what we have for the Big Bang. So if that happens, since you can't stop inflation everywhere at once, if I stop it here and I slow it down, you have sort of a Big Bang here, all the rest of the space is still inflating. And that's not a small thing, because remember, inflation that we have to give us conditions we can solve the problem we have with the Big Bang. We think it's, you know, 50 orders of magnitude and 10 to the minus, whatever, 30 some seconds. So that's not a small thing if the inflation is still going on.
So if you don't know how to stop inflation, then you naturally would expect to have sort of
inflating space, and maybe within it you form a different region of expanding space because you have a quantum fluctuation, and then within that you might form another. So you end up with this strange bubble multiverse of different types of space, inflating or accelerating, expanding it at different rates. Some of them, the physical constants, the way in which these extra dimensions got rearranged, you might have a universe that comes into existence and then sort of pop, sort of disappears because it doesn't have enough dark energy to, it may have dark energy that effectively has the opposite sign, basically causes the universe to collapse. So you can have a lot of different strange possibilities, but it all sort of happens in this matrix of an inflating space. So this is the idea of a bubble multiverse, and in this multiverse, these different regions of inflating space correspond to different arrangements of the six dimensions of space in string theory. And those correspond to different potential energies formed or stored in the vacuum of space. So they give you different degrees of inflation or accelerating or expansion, etc. And so you could have fluctuations in those, so you could move from one type of space to another, which is sort of what these inflating bubbles represent. So the idea is that if we believe in the sort of string theory view of space-time, and we look at the parameters that govern how you can twist up the six dimensions that we don't actually observe, you might expect to have local minima in the energy. So if this is a measure of energy and this is just a subset of the parameters that govern how space is all twisted together at every point in space for space-time, you expect to see about 500, 10 to the 500 of these. And because you have these quantum fluctuations coming up, basically sampling all these different possibilities of ways to twist the space together, you expect to populate all of these local minimum energy. In other words, you expect to have sort of stable-ish universes with different physical characteristics, with all different sets of physical constants and the such. And so you might expect to see the region we were talking about a little while ago, where you have the large region of space that holds physical characteristics similar to us, and this might be an infinitely large region of space, and we are disconnected from these regions just because of distance, that this corresponds to the size of reality, which is the largest we're ever causally connected to. But outside of that, okay, this multiverse, outside of that you might have an inflating matrix that maybe corresponds to the inflating space that we had from which a quantum fluctuation happened and basically gave birth to this region. It could also give birth to other regions that have different physical characteristics, and this would be a bubble multiverse. So you could have different physical laws over here. And I don't know how you stop it, so they call this eternal inflation. Yeah.
The expansion of the universe ever reversed or slowed down? Would these ever connect directly?
Yeah. You could. I mean, one of the things I think they had to worry about is the degree to which these might meet each other. So, but a way to think about it is it's everything is expanding here. So this bubble is expanding within this bubble, which is expanding. So it's all just growing. So, and this may also be expanding. So you're not colliding into something. It's all.
But is what the bubble that you're constantly connected to expanding independent of the expansion?
Yeah. I mean, our space is expanding. But you could have regions formed where you have a different amount of dark energy, if you will, enough so that you could have it formed such that you have inflation going and you sort of slow it down and then it can collapse. And that happens a lot, I think. So you can have these bubbles collapse, but if you have one where you have a stable system where it's accelerating, I think, or where it's expanding, it will just continue to expand while this inflating matrix expands around it. So I don't think it's going to eat us, if you will. But one of the weird things we find, for example, in ours is that the expansion is accelerating. So what that means is that the amount of reality that we experience in this causally connected bubble is actually going to get less and less. So in fact, we already see more of reality, I think, than we will, you know, a billion years from now if we were alive. And this just follows from inflation. And I don't know how to avoid it if you have inflation. So we cannot step outside and see this. But inflation is now starting to be scientifically fairly strongly supported. And these multiverses really are inferred directly from inflation. So it's a brave new world out there. How you guys doing? Sorry if I'm boring you with some of the stuff you've already seen. Some of it is a little different. So this does go up against intelligent design because our universe seems so finely tuned. If you change any of the parameters, then you would make our universe in such a way that we wouldn't be here. Stars might not go supernova, or they might not get hot enough to actually generate the fusion reactions inside of stars. So certain things, if you change, if the weak force were weaker, then the universe would all be helium-4 and you wouldn't actually initiate fusion reactions inside of stars. If the weak force were stronger, then all the neutrons would have decayed so fast you would not have formed anything except hydrogen. And if we look at how fusion reactions work in stars, it turns out that would be a problem. Cosmological constant is larger. That's sort of a measure of how much energy is tied into the vacuum of space, or is dark energy. Then the universe would expand too fast to form stars. If it were negative, then the universe would have collapsed before we ever formed any stars. If gravity were stronger, stars will burn faster and life would have less time to evolve. So there's all sorts of ways in which you can look at this kind of thing. So we call it fine-tuning. And so there are people who say, look, it's so complex and so finely tuned, obviously God did it. And that's what people really mean by intelligent design. And in and of itself, we've talked about religion and science, and, you know, if you want to believe God did it, you can always do that. There's nothing wrong with that. But part of the issue is when you want to do that and then tell other people that it's science and teach it as science. Okay, science has its limitations, but so these were some... This is George W. Bush because he was a proponent for intelligent design. You know, today class we're going to discuss the scientific theory of intelligent design. God did everything, class dismissed. So that's sort of the idea. I'm ridiculing it a little bit here. I don't really mean to ridicule it so much as my real problem with it is that I'm fine with it as a religion, a religious point of view, but if you start advertising it as science, then I have a real problem. Science has its own methodology. This doesn't fit it at all. And this is a very real thing if you're not used to running into this, okay? 46% of Americans believe in creationism. George Bush was endorsing teaching intelligent design theory. there are a couple of statements here. One is, it's not science, and we shouldn't try to have it substitute for science. That's not to say science doesn't have its limitations. Okay, so science does, but we have to be honest about what that is. The other thing that comes out of this is, even if you are very strongly against intelligent design as a scientific conclusion, which is really what I'm saying, you can't just look at something complex and say, oh, well, therefore God did it. That's basically just God of the gaps. And every time we learn something new, we just move God of the gaps a little bit further along. So I think God of the gaps doesn't really work. But there is an issue here, which is our universe is finite. So you have to have a compelling reason for that to come out of your scientific theory if you're going to argue that science has an explanation for that. And the multiverse is a way of doing that. That's sort of where multiverse and intelligent design run up against each other. In the sense that in the multiverse, you have some 10 to the 500 different ways in which you might rearrange these different six dimensions of space. Those would correspond to 10 to the 500 different sets of physical parameters, if you will. And in the big bubble multiverse, all of those get populated, and we just happen to find ourselves in one where we can exist. So it has a nice and natural explanation for the fine-tuning. So scientifically, that's actually compelling. I actually am not trying to beat up intelligent design, although maybe it's coming off that way. If you were a proponent of intelligent design, or you want to say God did it, I don't know why you feel threatened by this, because God can set it up to look like anything that you want. So it actually doesn't. I mean, I think if one has faith in that, you have to resolve your own personal issues about how God and science interact, and I don't. One of the things science has to do is to have, if you want to have a scientific cosmology, you have to have a natural explanation of why the universe is finely tuned. You may choose not to believe that's the one, and that's fine. Lots of people don't believe in evolution, but again, I don't think that's an excuse not to teach it in the schools, because scientific methodology has clearly been very successful, and we should teach all of our kids scientific methodology. Fine if you want to teach religious methodology as well, too, but I think it's irresponsible not to teach them these other things as scientific theories. Anyway, I don't know if I stepped over the line or if you guys want to say anything about any of that, argue about it. I'm not trying to beat it up. I'm just... Well, I could beat it up a lot more than I am, but then I start to cross the line from what I hope is being fairly objective into my own personal opinions. But all right. So one of the things is we now have carried the Copernican revolution to an extreme, right? We are in a universe that is just one of many possible. In fact, in the cosmic landscape, it is one of, 10 to the 500 different possibilities. We cannot go out there and find any of these things. So I don't know that we're in a better place than we would be if we just said God did everything class dismissed. Because now you say, we have cosmic landscape and anything can happen. So that becomes a natural answer as to how our universe sort of is the way it is. Which is very dissatisfying to a lot of people. And there are a lot of string theorists who want to find the ultimate theory of everything, and they are as unhappy with this whole idea of a cosmic landscape populating everything as they might be from somebody saying, well, God did everything. And it's almost a religious battle, because I don't know how you really resolve it. Short of somebody coming up with a really good, compelling reason to explain why there really is a special solution that everything settles into in string theory or whatever. And maybe they will. I don't know. But right now, we're sort of in a point where it's a religious question. So we may be reaching the point where the idea of inflation is starting to be scientifically accepted. Well, okay, I think that we've already been there, actually. It is, inflation does give us the correct power spectrum to describe the cosmic microwave fluctuations. It also gives us a way of understanding this strange effect on the polarization of the light in the cosmic microwave background. And those are pretty subtle things that would be sort of hard to just from scratch create a model that would explain it. So people do have inflation as part of our cosmological model. I believe if we have inflation, I don't know how you avoid the multiverse. So we may well be stuck with it. Is this the only way in which you can explain the data? And the one theory I know of right now that also can give you a power spectrum of that can give you a cosmic microwave background that has a power spectrum that is the fluctuations that are of the sizes and frequencies that we observe, in principle can also give you the same sort of thing, is called a periodic universe, and this one doesn't have inflation, but it has it's also pretty strange. In this one, you have three-dimensional space structures basically floating in an additional dimension, and the particles that we're used to dealing with most of the time are constrained to be in those three dimensions. You have a couple of these, they're separated by this other dimension where you might have gravity able to penetrate, but the other forces can't. And then they create this strange sort of system where effectively these three-dimensional objects within the greater number of dimensions sort of collide and move apart. And when they collide, because you have quantum fluctuations in the energy, you'll actually have interactions happening with a pattern. And they can make that pattern, where they touch, for whatever reasons, you actually have a release of energy. So you will have a pattern of energy basically being deposited in the three-dimensional volume of these spaces when they collide. And you can set this model up so that pattern agrees with the power spectrum of this energy depositions we seem to see in the universe that correspond with what we see in the cosmic microwave background. This model may also give some polarization signal, and I don't know how well established that is, but I believe, if not already, the data will be able to rule out or maybe make this more likely in time. But this is an example of... So the idea is you have these three spaces, they come together, you get this massive energy deposition that has a pattern that looks like sort of the start of our Big Bang. The space itself in the three dimensions you can have expanding because you can have dark energy and dark matter within each of those three spaces. As these grains, they call them, move apart, they basically are isolated and the space just expands. It looks very much like our universe. And then in time, they come back together, and when they come back together, it's almost like you come back to a new Big Bang. So it's a cyclic multiverse. But it's a very different picture from this idea of inflation that we have. It's strange enough, but it's rather different. So one of the cool things about science is you get this paradigm that seems to be very, very well supported that people sort of fall behind, and then we'll have some other idea or some other observation that makes things change. And who knows? Maybe this turns out to be the model. This one has no inflation in it. It doesn't get rid of the multiverse because it has its own. This one really isn't generally accepted by cosmologists. It's not what we call our standard model of cosmology, but these guys argue that that it should maybe be taken seriously. But I don't know to what extent, but for example, the polarization data that just came out is the kind of thing that can kill this whole theory relative to inflation. And I think some people believe that may have happened. I don't actually know enough about it to know whether it has or not. So here's another picture, sort of it. So you have this one dimension that we don't perceive, and these are actually three dimensions, so it's really hard to visualize. And basically, three dimensions, they collide with this deposition of energy, and then as they move apart, that energy goes into galaxies and clusters that have the same kind of structure that we used to see. So this effectively would be a Big Bang happening. It doesn't happen at a point, because you have all three dimensions of space colliding all at the same time. So it's an interesting, bizarre model. Another picture of it. We have talked at length about the quantum mechanical multiverse, where you can think of quantum mechanical processes as the collapse of a wave function. And you have a problem with that because the wave function has to have a large physical extent to allow the probability of everything to happen. And then when something happens, the probability is that that happened with a probability of 1 instead of all the possibilities that were possible right up until the quantum mechanical event happened. So this idea of having a probability distribution that collapses instantaneously really bothers people. And a way around it we talked about was given by this guy, Hugh Everett, his relative state formalism, where you have some large wave function that describes the whole universe, and all quantum possibilities happen, and they're basically separated within the dimensions you use in the quantum mechanical calculation, so that you can't perceive all the different possibilities, but the whole wave function just continues to evolve. But what it really means in that picture, if you have all of these possibilities, are different threads of reality within the larger wave function. So this is a distinct multiple universe from the cosmological ones that we were just talking about. In the cosmological ones, you can have the universe, which is just the reality that we're sort of part of, then you can have the universe where you have the bubble multiverse, that you sort of have these different bubbles formed. So those are sort of count as two different multiple universes. And within all of them, you can have quantum mechanics happening. And in principle, they could all be true at one time. So it's sort of very bizarre. I guess I did too much recapping last time I finished this today. So I'm sorry for the amount of time. Any comments, questions? Yes? Yeah, inflation gets rid of the singularity problem. Basically, it comes from a quantum fluctuation, which is an infinite energy in just only small space. You just have to be consistent with Heisenberg's uncertainties.
So the inflation says there's no singularity. There might be like particles.
With inflation, you don't have a necessarily a singularity to start with the Big Bang. Now, you may have singularities that come up in black holes. We don't actually understand what happens when you get close to having a singularity in terms of so much energy and matter in one spot that you have an infinite spot. We believe you don't ever actually get that because you have to have basically quantum gravity effects. But we don't have a working theory of quantum gravity, so we don't really know. In fact, this polarization is in principle an evidence of seeing gravitational waves that come from this inflationary effort And they started out as quantum fluctuations in gravity. So it's also a little bit evidence for quantum gravity. But people aren't really looking to find evidence for that. We're trying to understand the theory of it. But there's pretty generally accepted that we have to have some sort of quantum theory of gravity if we don't have that. So we have to move beyond this geometrical theory. When things get really energetic in small regions of space, general relativity doesn't work anymore. So we know there has to be something else there. There isn't quantum theory. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that answers your question.
Anything else? Wednesday's last day of class, so I'll do it. Finish this up, and then we'll see where we go from there.
By the way, I'm not planning to do a final exam for this class, right? So plan accordingly. You don't have to worry about that.